Hey everyone, welcome back to Broken to Barbell. We're starting year two. Well, we started last month, I guess. But this week we are going to talk with someone we found online. Her name is Beth Squarecki, and she runs the Life Hacker Vitals silo. Is that a good way to say it?
Vertical.
Vertical.
The media industry name for that. So it's like the section of Life Hacker that's about health.
Okay. Yeah, that's very cool. And we're going to ask her a lot of questions about her articles. I'm here, as always, joined with Sam up in Clarion.
Hello.
And Carly's here with us today, too. So
hi, everyone.
Yeah. I say, do we want to talk about where we're at currently? A little update on us?
Yeah, if you want.
Yeah. Sam, how's growing that eyeball going?
It's going good. I have just been super lazy and going to sleep at about 5 o'clock p.m. So that's a little earlier than my 7 o'clock usual bedtime. But other than that, I'm just trucking right along.
There you go. And you said you have two eyeballs now, right?
Me?
Yeah, there's two eyeballs you're growing now.
Yes.
That's so exciting.
Because my baby does have two eyes.
Yes, that's fun.
We would hope.
Yeah. I mean, usually that's the standard. Carly, what are you up to? You did something good at the gym yesterday, right?
Yeah, so I'm 4 weeks out today from my powerlifting meet. So I have about 2 heavy weeks left of training, and next week I have to wear my singlet in the gym.
Yes.
So all weekend I'll be mentally preparing for that.
Is this the first time you've done a meet?
Yeah. I've had my singlet on about 15 times since I got it 2 weeks ago, just to feel more comfortable in it. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just a very awkward thing.
Is it because it's like a onesie, essentially? Or is it just because of what it is?
It's very awkward. But I'm looking at it as everyone else is in them, too. So, well, not the gym. But at the meet, everyone has to wear a singlet. So,
I mean, personally, I feel like it probably just makes you look like a badass. Because, like, it's like when a superhero puts on their costume.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I don't feel like a badass in it, but we'll see. I mean, I know no one's looking at the singlet. They're looking at the weight I'm lifting, so.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm just getting really excited about it now, so it's the last home stretch, getting ready for it. But yeah, yesterday I had a really good squat session in the gym, so everything's coming together for me right
that's
now.
That's awesome.
That is so cool that you're doing a meet. I always wondered about, like, how those work and, you know, how you get into it.
Yeah, so I wanted to do the meet in December, which was a lot closer. So my meet's way out by Philly. It's like a 5-hour drive. And there was one in right outside of Morgantown, West Virginia, in December. And I wanted to do that meet, but I didn't register in time and it sold out. So I've been prepping mentally for this for a while now. So I'm coming up on my 1 year of training for it the same weekend as the meet. So in the big scheme of things, I haven't been training that long for it, but I pretty much really dialed in, I think, 15 weeks out. So the beginning of December was when I started doing cardio daily and really stuck to my diet, because I'm pretty much a flexible eater and eat pizza all the time when I'm not preparing for a meet. But I am definitely ready to cut eggs out.
Yeah, you said you're going to go on an egg sabbatical.
I'm very sick of eggs. But
well, I remember when I did my first Spartan race, it was like, I didn't care so much like what my time was or anything. It was like, I finished. So it's like, then I had a number to base everything else off of.
Yeah, well, which is what the meet's for.
That's what Ryan said too.
Getting a total.
You know, you don't have a total until you do a meet.
Yeah.
So.
And I just want to hit my lifts. Like, I don't care. At this point, I don't care what the weights are. I don't want to get any red lights on any of my lifts.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
That'll be fun.
Yeah. What about you, Tanner?
I'm having trouble getting back into the gym now that it's like nice out again. Like, I actually feel like going to the gym now. So I've been trying to do, and I've talked about it before, the volleyball workout regimen. Because there's, and some summer body workout regimen, just so it's like I have a list of things to do. Because that, if I go to the gym without a plan, then I suck. Like, I don't do anything. So, like, last night, I think I walked on the treadmill for 45 minutes, like the fast walk. And then I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to leave.
It's better than nothing.
Yeah.
At least you're in there.
Yeah. So, but that's what I'm trying to get into now. And I've even thought about, you love this, Carly. about getting a little skin in the game.
That's Tanner's favorite quote.
Because I was like, I'm just so much better when I'm like that kind of accountable. Yeah. So I was like, maybe I could, instead of doing like workout related, looking into some kind of nutrition or dietitian kind of like guidance to like make a meal plan, because mm-hmm. then that would be helpful on that aspect. Then it's like, okay, here's my meal plan. Now I'm really going to dive into one of my little bodybuilding.com workouts that I print out for free, but do something like that. So, and that's, so we might not have Spartan training this year. Like it might not happen. So I'm also kind of like, whoa, damn, like who can I find to work out with or do something that's similar to Spartan training? Just a group fitness class. Corey and I might sign up for the rowing team.
Nice. Yeah. That'd be cool.
Because he's like, oh, that would be fun to do. And I was like, all right, like I could get into something like that.
Yeah, I see them on the river. I don't know who it is, but I see the rowers on the river at like 6 a.m. before work.
If I am right, I think there's only one group of people. It's like the Pittsburgh Rowing Association. Yeah. So it's always somebody from that group that's rowing. Yeah. But I don't know that for a fact. So
yeah, keep us posted on that.
Yeah. So now we're probably going to get into the meat of everything with Beth. Mm-hmm. Beth has written some articles such as, "Will You Blab Your Secrets Under Anesthesia?" and "What to Do About a Mole in an Embarrassing Place." But she has way more articles than that. Those are just two of my favorites that caught my eye. So first we'll start just your background. What do you do? And from your mouth, you know, what do you, mm-hmm. what do you do? Who are you?
Hi, so I'm Beth Skoracki. I live here in Pittsburgh, but I work for Lifehacker. So it's this website about like anything to do with improving your life. So we're like always looking for, like, even if I cover news, it's on an angle of like, what does this study mean for you? Mm-hmm. And so I write about health, and occasionally other things. You said you found me through an article I wrote just about like Pittsburgh stuff.
Yeah.
But for the last few years I've been writing for Lifehacker. And before that I've written for, you know, Scientific American and for Medscape, which is this like medical website and things like that. So my background before that is in, biology. I have a bachelor's in biology, and actually straight out of school, I went to, I was doing like computer stuff and I was doing programming for a bioinformatics team. And then one day I was just like, you know what? I don't like this. I want to be a writer. And so I sort of slowly worked my way up to where I'm like, now I'm living my dream from 10 years ago. I'm a full-time, you know, health and science writer. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. That's pretty really fun. Awesome.
That's cool. I'm just reading now a book called The Freelance Manifesto. Mm-hmm. And it's about motion design and freelancing and stuff like that. But you're on staff, right?
Yeah. But I was freelance for a very long time.
Okay. Yeah, because it's just getting into that and thinking the career of your dreams kind of mm-hmm. mentality, you know, and making it what you want it to be and making that plan. So that's really cool that you got what you wanted, you know, and mm-hmm. then you're able to do that. So
Yeah. And it is hard to be a freelancer because it's not just can you do the work, it's like can you build your business, mm-hmm. you know, and can you make sure that you're getting enough work and that you're like paying the bills while you're working towards whatever you want to do next.
It's like you have to use both halves of your brain, mm-hmm. right and the left. You know, one of you has to be the businessman in the suit and the other one has to be the creative, like flower child, you know,
yeah,
that gets
exactly.
to like go out and have fun. Like you got to get that separation to sell yourself and then do the work, you know, mm-hmm. like, so I can imagine that that's very challenging. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. It's hard. So that's why when I got, you know, a job offer to just like do it full time. So I'd been freelancing for Lifehacker for a while and they were like, okay, do you know, we've made some room in the budget. Do you want to come on full time? And I'm like, yes, because then I can put like the business half of my brain on autopilot.
Yeah.
And yeah. like, I know that I just have to show up and do some writing and that I'm always going to have a certain paycheck coming in. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just like, I have three kids now and
wow,
you know,
okay.
and it's just like, it's just so nice to be able to like put that part of my life on autopilot.
Oh, I can imagine. Because then, like you said, you've got that, the consistency and the safety with mm-hmm. that comes with it. So
yeah,
I can totally understand that.
I mean, the whole like media industry is also, you know, like every time I look on Twitter, some other publication is, you know, laying off writers or some publication is launching or like there's always, you know, like people going to new places. So it's like not a place of stability exactly, but it's like a day-to-day stability.
It sounds like a definitely maybe not stability, but opportunity, mm-hmm. you know, if the positive spin on it is opportunity,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So real quick, I saw on your Twitter actually, where you tweeted, some reassuring information for young writers. I write every day for a living. I've been at this for a decade. I'm working on my second book and I still have days where I almost can't bring myself to start because writing is hard and I'm afraid it will be bad. And I think we tried to blog monthly from our Broken to Barbell website and all of us were like, this is hard, you know,
struggling.
Like
it is so hard.
And it's, and I'm constantly thinking like, what are people going to think about what I'm writing? So I rewrite it like 18 times. And then I'm constantly sending Sam and Tanner links to blogs that I wrote. And I'm like, guys, can we read these? Will you give me feedback? Should I publish it? And now I'm to the point where I'm like, I'm just going to publish it, go for it, and then get feedback instead of being so hard on myself from the jump. So seeing you say that and you're working on your second book, like I think a lot of people look at writers like you and think like, wow, they must have all these ideas like swirling in their head and they can just write for hours, but like to see you put that out on Twitter that it is hard and it's not always going to be free-flowing ideas.
Yeah. And because the thing is like I felt that way at the beginning and it's like, okay, well, I'm new to this, and then you know it keeps on feeling that way, like even you know when things are going well on paper, like, oh, I'm getting these assignments and whatever. It's like, still like, I don't want to write. I, you know, have a hard time getting off Facebook and, you know, over to Google Docs, you know?
Yeah.
But then I started noticing other writers saying the same thing, include, you know, like, Ed Yong, who's a science writer, who's just like absolutely amazing. I saw him tweet something one day years ago. And I can't find the tweet. I went looking for it, but he said something like, it was about like that moment when you send your finished draft off to the editor to turn it in, and about that feeling of like, oh no, this is shit, and everybody will realize I'm an imposter, and this is when, you know, like this is when it all goes down. It's like that's the feeling that he admitted to having every time he sends off a draft, and it's like, I have that too.
Yeah.
And it was pretty cool to see somebody who was like very successful and obviously a very good writer who got to work with very good editors having that same feeling, and I realized not just how true it is, but how important it is to like make sure that everybody knows that we all feel this. And the more I talk to writers, I haven't met anybody that doesn't feel that way. So that's my pinned tweet. And like,
I love it.
Like, that's my service to the world.
I screenshotted it. I'm like, I'm going to go back to that whenever I'm feeling like I shouldn't write something. So thank you for tweeting that.
Yeah. No, it's awesome. They talk about that in the motion design book too. It's imposter syndrome. You know, it's like, I don't belong here. The day is going to come that they're going to find me out, you know?
And yeah.
Like, it's like, no, literally everyone feels that way. Just, okay, I'm scared about it and let it go. You know, let's move past it. So I think it's very powerful to at least put a name to it. And then, okay, now we gotta, it's addressed. Let's move forward.
Yeah. And it's even like once you, even if you can sort of get over like the imposter part of it, or like some people might, you know, feel confident that they're like in the right job or whatever, but just like in the moment, you're like, oh, but it's not time for me to sit down and write. You know, it's like, oh, but this one, you know, like you'll drag your feet on things. And, you know, like I think some amount of that continues your whole career no matter what. And you just have to like recognize that, like, okay, if it feels bad, that's normal. You know, just like when you're in the gym, you know, if something hurts or if you're having like a bad day or you're not lifting as much as you want, it's like, that doesn't mean sit at home. You know, it means like you keep on doing it and you're still going to be better for having gone that day. But it's really good that you guys can like send drafts to each other, right? And like talk about it. And, you know, like it's great to have that, you know, like that communication and feedback and whatever, so you don't feel so alone. You know, although I'm wondering like if that helps or if that's just like an extra set of eyeballs breathing down your neck.
Yeah. So I send my drafts to my brother too, who also writes. He actually is more on like the screenplay spectrum. Like he writes a lot of movies that never see the light of day, and except for me, I read all his stuff.
Yeah, the fact that he's writing them though is way better than people who aren't.
Yeah. You know? So I send him my articles too, and I'll send them to my mom, and then my mom will like get upset about something I said, so I quit sending them to her. She takes everything to heart. So yeah, I send them to a few different people, but like my brother is always like, you're a little repetitive. He's like, you talk about sobriety all the time. I'm like, that relates to me. So yeah. I like use that as a basis. But I mean, I like sending you sometimes, you guys don't always reply with feedback, which is cool. But then so like getting over that hump where I can just publish them and not care what people. Well,
your style of writing too is because it's a blog, to me, it's a stream of consciousness, and your thought always makes sense and always has a story. So to me, I don't really have many changes usually because it's like you've got a story. So it's awesome. You know, it's your thoughts. Yeah.
So as far as when you write, I mean, I'm sure it varies on what you write and what your topic is, but like a time frame, do you have like, do you come up with like an outline, or do you just kind of spew your thoughts into a collective document and then review it, or how?
It's sort of a mix of a lot of different strategies depending on what I'm writing. Mm-hmm. So for like the day-to-day stuff, you know, I'm into enough of a groove with Lifehacker, and like I know, you know, when I was freelancing, I would have to like think of a bunch of ideas and then decide which ones were worth researching further, and then get to a point in that research when I decide, okay, this is an idea worth trying to sell to somebody, and then I try mm-hmm. to get somebody to pay me, somebody to assign me to write it, you know. So mm-hmm. with a staff job, it's a little bit easier, you know, or if you have like a blog where like you know what kinds of things you want to put on it. So a lot of my stuff is like I come up with an idea, and then I think about when I'm going to write it. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I come up with an idea, like our workflow here is I put it on the schedule, and I can move it from the schedule if I need to, but that gives me an idea of like, okay, this has to publish at 3:00, which means I have to have it to the editor no later than 2:00, which means if it's like a quick, you know, dash out a few paragraphs kind of thing, I can start writing it at 1:00 that day. Mm-hmm. Because I know I can do it. Or mm-hmm. Or if it's something that requires research, I'm like, okay, how much research am I going to have to do? How many people am I going to have to talk to? And if I want to have like 2 or 3 interviews to do for it, even if they're quick interviews or like email quotes, I need to reach out to probably more than 3 people to get 3 people to 3 come responses. Back to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think, you know, a lot of those I'll be like, okay, well, a week ahead of time. So I'm always having to like think about, you know, like what am I doing next week and am I preparing for that? And then when it comes time for writing, like, so if it's like a longer piece, let me try to think through my process for this. Like I sometimes do an outline. I don't always. What helps me is to envision like what the finished article is going to look like. And so I try to have a headline first thing, mm-hmm. you know, like a lot of people will just write something and then try to come up with a headline afterwards. But like your headline is going to be your tweet, you know, it's going to be like a lot of people will just see the headline in the picture and not necessarily read further. And you want to make sure that you're like capturing what you're trying to say in that headline. Mm-hmm. And so I try to think about that. And usually we try to break it up with like subheadings. And so it's sort of thinking in terms of an outline to think, okay, well, what are my subheadings going to be? Or like, what are these sections going to be? Try to figure out how the pieces will get together. But there's a little bit of a chicken and egg kind of thing, right? That like, you don't really know what the piece is going to be until you start writing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just kind of have to, you know, like the earlier I start writing, even if it's not like the exact words that go into it, the earlier in the process I start actually putting words down on paper, the easier the subsequent steps get. And that's yeah. one of those things just like in that tweet that I always, you know, sort of forget. And I'm like, oh, I don't know what to do next.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I get that way with even schoolwork. I don't know what to say, and it's got to be perfect. I'm like, just start yeah. word vomiting for yeah. me onto paper, because then it's like, oh, that sentence is garbage, but this one works, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's how I have to work, because then it's like, it's no longer swirling around in my head kind of
yeah.
thing.
And so actually, that's a thing I do like to get unstuck when I'm like, not sure what to do. It's like, you know what? Just set a timer for 10 minutes and like make a list of things I might want to talk about in this piece, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, a list of sources I might go to, or, you know, like whatever it might be. And I find that really helps, because then you realize you do have ideas. Like yeah. you've just been sort of like stopping them from coming out, but you do have ideas. You do have something to work on, you know, and that really helps.
Yeah, that's cool. That's well, even from like a fitness standpoint, or mm-hmm. even a mental health standpoint, is the, like, I want to do the dietitian thing or whatever. It's like, start writing down a meal plan, just because I'm not, I might never actually do that, but at least get the ideas out of my head onto paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can decide, nope, that one's garbage, but this one's really good, you know,
yeah.
like do something like that.
Yeah. Or sometimes even just write a list of like what you like and what you hate, you know? So in terms of meal plans, you can write down like, I hate when it takes me, you know, 45 minutes to put together a meal, you know, or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's like, I love when I get to make an evening out of cooking, like whatever yeah. it is, like write down what you love, what you hate. And if nothing else, that'll give you some like ideas for what to look for when you're looking up your meal plan.
Yeah. Then you start to put the steps together, you know, mm-hmm. all the pieces come together. So some of your articles, you wrote an article, and I was having trouble finding it this morning, but about supplements.
Yeah.
So what's your opinion on supplements?
So, okay. So it, personally for me, it's kind of easy because I don't have like a specific like sport I'm trying to win a gold medal in. Mm-hmm. Right. So, but like personally, I don't really do supplements. I don't really see them as very necessary. But it depends a lot on what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
But I do think that it's important to remember that a lot of them are on the market because somebody wants to sell them. And they get written yeah. about because, you know, what else are you going to write about? Like, write about how great this new supplement is. And so there's a lot of incentives for companies to market them and for people to write about how great they are, and very little incentive for anybody to, you know, really say, like, wait a sec, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, unless it's like an article on, you know, bodybuilding.com or something about like, don't do that supplement, do this supplement. Mm. So I'm very skeptical of the whole industry. Like, I'm sure some of these supplements, you know, do things for you. But
Sam, what are you doing? Yeah.
I'm not doing anything.
Oh, you were moving something and it sounded like they were like scratching on chalk or something.
Oh, sorry.
That's fine.
Yeah. So I can't speak to the whole industry. But at least in the powerlifting, at least in my powerlifting gym, are my trainers, the owners of the gym, they don't do supplements. They
oh, really?
They don't agree with supplements.
Well, they're so heavy on diet too.
Yeah.
But
protein heavy everything. Yeah. So I mean they think whatever supplements you need you can get from what you're eating.
Yeah. And like nutritionally, I think that's you know, that's got to be true, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're, you know, in terms of, you know, protein, like, okay, if you want to do like a protein shake or something, because that's just like more convenient for your day, mm-hmm. you know, but like there's protein in food, you know?
Yeah. Well, I do 2 protein shakes a day. So mm-hmm. they're good with protein powder.
Yeah.
I think to me, that's a little bit different than yeah. a supplement.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Ooh, this is E12.
And now there's all these like Plexus and it works and all these pyramid scheme
yeah
things on Facebook. Everyone's a supplement
guru.
Yeah. Yeah, so what do you think about those?
Yeah, I mean like
gut health.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean like a lot of them, like a lot of these products just exist so they have something to sell, you know, and that doesn't mean there's like no basis to them, you know, like creatine is a thing and it really does have an effect on your body, but like the size of that effect compared to what you get from like going to the gym and eating well and stuff, like it's not going to add that much. So
yeah, it's not the easy button mm-hmm. from Staples kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. And even for things where like there is like a measurable effect in a study and we know that if you take this, you know, in this scenario, it'll do this for you. It's like back up and consider your whole life. Like, in your life, what is going to get you to your goals more? And, you know, like the same money you spend on like a jar of some supplement, you could spend on, you know, a personal training session or
a week worth of food.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, or like, that's what I think. Like some of those things, it's like, oh, it's a flash sale and it's $65. It's like, man, you could literally buy a good chunk of food for your week. Like mm-hmm. as a single guy, like, well, I'm not single. Sorry. As a guy
like
who
how many dozen eggs
lives
is
alone.
That?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's like I could get a ton of food for a good chunk of food for $65, or like my lunches for the week or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, like versus a pill. We got those pills at that
the brain health one.
The brain health. We got these like brain oh, yeah. health pills. So I put them in hot water because I wanted to see like what they were, mm-hmm. and it dissolved the outsides, and it literally looked like mayonnaise that was on the inside.
Ew. Ew.
I don't know what was in them, but
there is a brain health supplement that Joe Rogan really pushes. I listen to Joe Rogan's podcast a lot. And Sam, do you know, is it from Onnit?
Yeah, it's a nootropic is what type
but
of.
But he pushes it like every pod. I'm like, I wonder if
so
Joe
what's
Rogan's.
In it?
I don't know. He doesn't go into it into detail.
I'm curious now.
Something about brain, how your brain works. Isn't it, Sam? I don't. I'm just basing this off of what I hear in the advertisements that I clearly don't listen to on his podcast.
Yeah, I think it's so weird to sell something without even telling people what's in it. Like, I'm sure there's an yeah. ingredients label or something, but like if you're just listening to, even when it's cold medicines, like if I'm shopping for a cold medicine, it's like, this is good for your cough. And it's like, Okay, but is it a cough suppressant? Is it an expectorant? Is it a decongestant? Mm-hmm. You know, like what kind of thing is it? What's it going to do to you? And is it the same thing I have in my cabinet at home under a different name?
It's just a chopped up mint leaf. That's all it is.
Yeah. It could be. So like, it's important to know what's in a supplement. And so that this is like an issue with the supplement industry, you know, in our country and the way it's regulated. They're not regulated like food and they're not regulated by like drugs. So it's sort of like on the honor system, what you put into it. Like the FDA is technically, you know, has a regulatory umbrella over supplements, but it's not like a drug where you have to prove it works and get it approved. It's just like, oh, I want to put this into a pill and sell it to people.
There's
and
not rat poison in it.
Yeah. You know, like there's probably not rat poison in it, but like nobody's necessarily going and testing for it.
Yeah.
And there have been like some very, you know, scary findings where somebody goes and tests some pills and, you know, there might be something poisonous in there. There might be just none of what was supposed to be in there. There might be like some of the stuff they put in might have, you know, unintended effects. Like they're saying, oh, we used, you know, like the leaf of such and such plant, but maybe when you get a lot of the leaf of such and such plant, maybe that's not good for you. And that hasn't necessarily been studied in depth. And there are also supplements that, you know, because they want you to feel like it's working, they'll put things in it to make it feel like it's working or seem like it's working. And you know, and that can range from like caffeine, you know, and it's like you want to know how much caffeine you're putting in your body, to things that, you know, will get you disqualified under doping rules. You know, and like people who are in like college athletics or the Olympics or whatever, like really have to pay attention to what they're actually taking. And like, do you trust whoever's making the supplement that they're not putting something in there that's going to get you banned from your sport?
That shouldn't be. Yeah.
And it happens. Like people get, you know, disqualified for things they didn't realize they were taking.
That's crazy. You see that all the time in professional sports too. Like the best example in Pittsburgh is the Starling Marte PED story last year. It came out that he was using performance enhancing drugs and he claimed he didn't know what he was taking.
Yeah. And but, I mean, sometimes, you know, like you're like, okay, is that a story? But there are also people who've gone and tested some supplement. There was a study, you know, maybe a couple weeks ago. I didn't read it in depth, but I saw that it was a study where they were like, oh, look at, you know, we took this sample and this percent of them had some kind of performance enhancing drugs or something that would get you, you know, flagged for that.
That's wild.
Well, even in, I mean, my meat in powerlifting isn't drug tested, but they have drug tested meats. And it's like, I wouldn't even risk taking something if I didn't know what was in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it would just be so easy to fail a drug test and then be like, oh my God, this girl's on steroids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's embarrassing. So like I wouldn't put myself in that situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, well, I just watched a video about homeopathic drugs.
Okay.
And how, so I think the one measure was 30C, which means like,
is a 1 in 100 dilution done 30 times.
Done 30 times.
Which is like a lot of zeros.
So they did a test and found that some of the things with the 30C didn't even have an atom. Mm-hmm. Like not a single atom of the original substance or leaf or whatever it was that was in it. It's like, so it was literally just water.
Yeah.
Like it was.
Yeah,
like,
a lot of those are. Yeah, a lot of homeopathic stuff like literally does not and cannot have anything in it.
It's
just water or just, you know, whatever their inactive ingredient is.
Water and a little bit of crushed up mint leaf.
Yeah. But then again, you know, like it's hard to like lump all the homeopathic stuff together. I mean, like I can lump it together as in like it doesn't work, it's garbage. Like that's the truth. But sometimes they'll do like a very small dilution and, you know, like arnica gel, you know, they're like, oh, this is homeopathic, but it's like it's only like a 1 in 10 dilution or something, and it's like, oh, there's actually a lot of arnica in that gel, you know. And so there's actually these baby teething tablets that were they were supposed to have like little to nothing of their active ingredient, but they had enough of it that they actually killed some babies.
Oh my god.
Wow.
Yeah, it was belladonna, which is like a deadly nightshade kind of poison, and they're like, oh, but if we put just the tiniest little bit and dilute it out, and there's and people who do homeopathy, they know there's nothing in it because they tell you it's perfectly safe because there's nothing in it. But there was enough in it that it made some babies sick and it killed some.
That's crazy. That's like the definition of a snake oil salesman, you know, like there's snake venom in this, but it's good for you in a small amount.
Yeah, they have this whole theory for like, it's the process of diluting that like magically enhances the vibrations of the something in the water. And like, there's a theory that would hold together in some sort of magical universe that isn't this universe, but like, it doesn't work with physics as we know it.
I like the spiritual spin on it all. It contains the essence of whatever that thing was, the spirit of it. That sounds poetic.
Yeah. There's a whole nother thing that's not considered homeopathy, but that's flower water and flower remedies. And so I went to Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop Summit thing.
Oh, okay.
And so somebody there was telling me about how in this one garden in England, they pick these specific flowers and put them in a crystal bowl full of water in the sunshine for so many hours. And then they take that water and they put a few drops of it into brandy, and then they sell that to you, and it's got the like concentrated vibrations, like the magical vibrations of this flower, and it can do something for you.
I want that job, first of all. Pick some flowers and drop it into brandy.
Like, idyllic. Like, oh, I have to float my flowers in the bowl today.
It probably smells. That's like probably a great job. It smells good. Like, just out in the garden.
When you're making it. But like, by the time you like buy the flower essence, it's literally just brandy. Maybe with some water mixed in.
Yeah, you would think that the brandy would probably kill the flower essence at that point.
Oh, that's true. But what is it? It's a magical vibration. Can you kill that? I don't know.
Are magical vibrations regulated by the FDA?
That's a good point. As far as I know, they are not.
So you also wrote an article about your fitness and genetics.
Yeah.
Too. So, and if I remember correctly, in the article you said your genetics play a huge role in your fitness. You just have to kind of find what's right for you, correct?
Yeah. I mean, like, it's a little bit of a complicated question, you know, especially now that there's all these like DNA testing companies. Like, I wrote this before there were so many
23andMe kind of things.
Yeah, like 23andMe was around, but like you could get an analysis and whatever. But now there's like a whole bunch of things that are like, we will sell you a workout program based on your genetics, or we will sell you a diet plan based on your genetics.
I bet that's how that article was framed, now that I'm thinking about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was this the article that had the negative results?
No, I don't think so. It was
I just read one of yours the other day. I can't remember the title, but
oh, it was the one about like a big diet study just threw out a lot of people's pet theories.
Yeah, and you said like that you were pumped that they posted it because it was a negative result.
Yeah,
and they didn't try to spin it into something that it wasn't.
Right. Yeah. So this one, So we're talking about the second article now. This one about this new diet study, which I think is a fascinating study. So they took a bunch of people. They had 600 people, and they put half of them on a low carb diet and half of them on a low fat diet. And they thought that they knew three specific variants in your DNA that they could say, okay, which variant do you have at this part of your DNA? What do you have at this part? What do you have at this part? And then based on that, they'd be like, oh, you're best suited for the low fat diet or for the low carb diet, or maybe you just have like a mix of the genes and you're not really either. Mm-hmm. And so they assigned people randomly to each diet, but then they looked at who was on the diet that matched their genetics. And judging just from these three genes, just these three that they picked, right, out of like the thousands they could have, like these were the three they thought would give them a good result, it didn't matter at all. And so, and this was like a study where like they thought, like the scientists doing it thought they had a good theory for why these genes would affect your ability to lose weight, and they were pretty sure they understood it, but they're like, and they had a previous study that, you know, was how they identify these and why they thought it was going to work. And they said, okay, we need to test it in a bigger population, you know, like a bigger, better study design, which is great.
How big was the study? Do you know?
This study that just came out was 600 people.
Okay. So it's pretty big, but still, yeah.
Yeah. Like it's hard
to do. The more people you add, the better data you're going to have. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's hard to like handle that many people in a study because you're going to each one of them and trying to figure out what they ate. And like they had some ways of like testing what they actually ate rather than just relying on what they did. So sometimes you'll see studies that were done of like thousands and thousands and thousands of people, but they're usually done a different way. They'll have a survey that they just send out to like all, you know, 30,000 people enrolled in the such and such giant study. And they'll be like, okay, what do you eat? What do you weigh? And then
like self-reporting kind of.
Yeah. And, you know, and like each of these study designs has their place. You know, it's not like one of them is like always wrong, but it's like you have to recognize the limitations of what each of them could get you.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I was excited that they were publishing it, even though it basically said, you know, like these genes did not help us figure out who would do better on which diet. So that was just like a very interesting finding, I think.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, but going back to like genetics and fitness, you know, a lot of the things that they can test for, you know, like if you do like a 23andMe or like one of these, you know, consumer oriented DNA tests, they'll give you a few things like, you know, whether you're more of a sprinter or an endurance runner. But that's based on one variant in one gene. And so I did one of these and it told me like, you're built for endurance. And I am not. Like from, you know, like years of experience and trying to run marathons and trying to run, you know, like sprinting and whatever. It's like, no, I've figured out which of those I'm good at, you know, but this one gene is, you know, I think in the article that you're talking about that I wrote a few years ago, the person I talked to said that's going to account for maybe 1 or 2% of that question. Like that gene is going to contribute 1 or 2% to the answer to that question, you know? So even if you do have that, you know, even if it is true, which is still like not 100% sure, even if it's true that that gene gives you something different in your muscle fiber, it also depends like, okay, but like, what's your cardio endurance going to be like? How are your lungs built? How is your muscles structured? How, you know, like psychologically, which do you prefer? Yeah. Like I go crazy on long endurance runs, but I really enjoy something like short and focused.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of have to not read too much into your results because like, yeah, maybe this is telling you the absolute truth of what's in your DNA, but it's not telling you that that one part of your DNA is like dictating the absolute truth about you.
What is it? What's it called? Like the not end all to be all or something like that's what I'm trying to get at. But you know, it's not the, the rule, you know, it's like an insight. So
But when you said like a lot of, you know, what we do and who we are comes down to genetics, like it does. We just like scientifically don't yet understand most of that yet.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Sam, go ahead with your question.
So my question was, I understand you have three children. Mm-hmm. What is your take on fitness while pregnant?
Oh yeah. So, I think it's great. so with my three kids, with my first kid, I didn't like, I really wanted to work out while I was pregnant, but like, I just wasn't feeling it. And we moved and we were like doing repairs on the house and, you know, so I didn't do much with my second. And then with my third kid, I was a little more like that, you know, just sort of like taking it easy. But with my second, I was like, screw this. I just started training for a marathon when I got pregnant. And you know what? I'm just going to run the marathon. And so my thought was actually, I will go as far as I can in the marathon training and do like whatever my body feels is right. And mm-hmm. I probably won't get to the marathon, but that's okay. I'll just stick with this training group because I was having fun. And I did end up running the marathon. I ran it 5.5 months pregnant.
That is so awesome.
And to be honest, I feel like I was good with the running up until about 4.5 months. But at that point I was like, I just have to crawl over the finish line. I've gotten this far.
Yeah. It's just like, so did you do a full marathon?
It was a full marathon.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
That is insane.
I should like try to do the half marathon or something. I've never done one before. That would be fun.
Yeah. Do you run at all?
Just through Spartan training. Mm-hmm. So the most I've ever done in a race was 10 miles.
Oh,
so,
you could do half. Yeah. I mean, a half's 13.
Well, and I think I'm curious how easy it would be because it's not like I'm stopping to do burpees or obstacles.
You're going to find the half marathon so much easier
than a race like that. Well, yeah. Oh my God. That was the Barber Beast on the Bay up in Erie. So a good 4 or 5 miles on it was on sand.
Oh,
it was horrible. I literally wanted to die.
A half marathon on like city streets is going to be so much easier.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I'll look into that. Maybe that'd be a good goal for myself to do. Yeah.
So did you run the Pittsburgh Marathon?
Yeah. It was the Pittsburgh Marathon in 2012.
That's awesome.
So,
that's incredible that you did it pregnant. I mean, I think of it like I couldn't do that without a baby in my...
Well, the thing is, I have not run another marathon since because I remember just how grueling the training was and how hard it was. And I was like, I'm not going to do that again. You know, it's like sort of in my bucket list is like run another marathon. Like I know that I could if I put my mind to it, but like it's a lot of time in the training, like time away from your family. And like the more kids I have, the more family I'm getting away from.
Yeah.
Although it could be nice to get away from the family, but
the little break.
Yeah.
So how did you feel like on the marathon day? Because I've heard a couple of different stories from people that have ran the Pittsburgh Marathon and that have also ran other cities' marathons and said that Pittsburgh's is their favorite because at every little town or whatever, every little piece of it, there's people cheering you mm-hmm. on and whatnot. They said it's an exciting marathon to run.
It is. I haven't run any other marathon, so I can't tell you. But yeah, running Pittsburgh was fun. So let me see if I can like go through like my race day thoughts.
So like at what point of it did you feel like, I'm not going to finish this? Did you feel like, I'm not going to finish this?
Give us a breakdown of the whole day.
That's okay. All right. So I'm thinking back here. I can't promise it's all accurate.
That's fine.
Okay. So leading up to it, I was getting like major cold feet because like I had a really good run maybe a month beforehand. Okay. And so just to back up about your like run, you know, exercise and pregnancy question, like, you know, I was going to the midwife center, but the midwives are like very evidence-based in their care. Like they're not woo-woo at all. And I was, you know, when they first asked me like, are you exercising? I was like, I run. And they were like, oh, that's great. What do you run? And I was like, I'm sort of training for something. And they're like, oh, that's great. What are you training for? And I'm like, a marathon. And they're like, oh, that's great. And I'm like, oh, okay.
That's awesome. You had that support too, you know?
Yeah. And they were giving me advice and they were saying like, this is actually from a previous pregnancy, but one of the midwives had told me, if anybody tells you that you need to keep your heart rate under 140 beats per minute, that is absolute garbage. Nobody believes that anymore. That's not true. So just go by feel, you know, and they gave me a lot of advice about like what sorts of things to watch out for. You have to be extra sure about your blood sugar, especially when you're mm-hmm. running and you're like eating like those little gel packets or whatever. You have to make sure that you keep that up. And I definitely had some days in training where I wasn't very good about that. And I felt like dizzy and nauseous and had to sit down.
Just because you didn't have enough fuel?
Yeah, it was like low blood sugar, you know, mm-hmm. or possibly high blood sugar because they can feel similar. But like I was getting some like blood sugar swings that, you know, were not great. So it's like sit down, have something to eat, you know, rest, you know, maybe you're done for the day. You know, you have to be good about hydration. You have to be good about body heat, because if your body gets too hot, that's not good for the baby. That's why you'll also see recommendations like don't sit in a hot tub, you know. But they did say like, you will know, like if you get too hot, like sit down, you know, just it's all about listen to your body and like don't push yourself farther than you feel like you should. And so that's pretty much like the rule of thumb that I got both from them and from like all the research I've done, because I've written about it too, is like, if you listen to your body, you know, like you have to actually be listening to your body, right? Yeah. Like it's easy to push past and be like, no, I can do this. But like, if you really are, you'll end up doing the right thing pretty much. And so that was, you know, what I went with. So I kept on running, and the really frustrating thing is, no matter how much I trained, and I was really consistent in my training, because when I had morning sickness or whatever, like I'd feel awful. I'd be like, I don't want to run. But I knew that I was going to feel just as awful if I stayed home as if I ran. So I might as well just get out there and run.
That's half my battle half the time. It's like, I'm going to feel crappy at the gym, or I'm going to feel crappy on my couch at home. So
yeah,
let's at least go to the gym.
Yeah. And you know, now in the pregnancy after that, I was just like, fuck it, I'm staying home. But but that was a thing that got me out. Like I'd be feeling awful and I'd be like, I'm going to feel awful either way. At least I can get some miles in.
Yeah.
So I was training like fairly consistently, and we were doing like some hill runs and some strength work and stuff. And I kept getting slower. That was the most frustrating thing, because I started out like training with this group of people, you know, like this big group that was put together by like the Elite Runners store. They had like this big marathon training group. And I was like, I wasn't the slowest person, but I was like toward the back of the pack. But that's okay. You find somebody else in the group who's about your speed and you run the long runs together.
Yeah.
And so, but like after a few weeks, like even before I'm showing, even before I look pregnant or feel pregnant very much, like I'm getting slower. I'm already getting slower, and I can't run with that person who I had the exact same time as on the first day. So I'm running with another group of people and I'm falling a little further back.
Yeah.
but I got to be good friends with the people who are at the very back of the pack, and we ran a lot together. So it was just so frustrating to like train so much and train so hard, and no matter what, you get slower. So by the time I showed up on race day, you know, like if I wasn't pregnant, I would probably be aiming for a marathon somewhere in the like 4 hours to 4:30. But I showed up at I knew there was a 6 hour course limit, and I showed up and there was a pace group that was aiming for 5:30. And I ended up sticking with them for most of the course, but not quite all of it. I finished in 5:45. So I was out there running on a 90 degree day.
Oh,
like
my.
I was training in the snow, and then marathon day was 90 degrees. for 5 hours and 45 minutes that's why I won't do that again. But anyway,
when I get running with Spartan Training too, I get like Dory the fish from Finding Nemo. I'm like, just keep swimming.
Yeah.
You know, the Santa Claus is coming to town with the snow, the winter warlock. Put one foot in front. And that like gets stuck in my head. I'm like, oh my God, stop it.
So was like your husband at the finish line or at a certain point in the race? Because my cousin's wife ran the marathon. She ran in the Pittsburgh one once. And her husband and her kids couldn't be there on race day, but my aunt was there, my cousin's mom. And mile 22, I think she was there like cheering her on. And she said if Maggie wasn't there, she didn't think she was going to finish it. Like she needed that push with that like 4 miles left or whatever. And she said if she didn't see her there, she probably would have just collapsed or something. Like she said she needed that. So were your family members there that day?
My family was not there. My husband, so I had one kid already at this point. So my husband was going to bring the baby to, you know, and like meet me at the finish line. Mm-hmm. But he didn't like think ahead enough in terms of like traffic and parking and didn't make it. But that's okay. Like my thinking on this was like, I'm really just doing this for bragging rights, because if I am 5.5 months pregnant and capable of running the marathon, I will forever be able to say I ran that marathon while pregnant.
Yeah.
And like, that's why I'm here telling you this story right now.
That's awesome. Yeah.
If I had chickened out at the last minute, I wouldn't have this story. So like, that was like literally the only thing pulling me at that point, because like it didn't feel good. I had to go to this like maternity store and find myself this like weird band to like help hold my belly up, because otherwise it hurt.
Yeah.
It wasn't pretty. None of this was pretty in the training or anything.
I feel like you should have had your own feature in the Post-Gazette. Like, woman runs in a full marathon in under 6 hours while pregnant.
Yeah. Well, before like maybe a couple months before this, somebody had run a marathon while pregnant, and she was like going into labor during the marathon. Oh. So she got in, but she was like 9 months pregnant. Like, yeah. Okay.
Oh, wow.
But she had the baby like that day or the next day. And then
crossed the finish line.
And so there was like news articles about her, and people being like, oh, you shouldn't do this. This is terrible. Can you imagine? You know, and it's just like I didn't necessarily want press. Like, I decided to talk about it later. But it's just like, leave me the fuck alone. It's hard enough.
And that woman's child is named Nike.
Yeah. My general thought on it is just from a human condition standpoint. It's like, we were hunter-gatherers and had to run from animals all the time before. Yeah. And so I'm sure a pregnant woman at some point in the history of being a human being ran from a tiger for several miles.
For 26 miles. Yeah. I don't know. That's a stretch, I think.
Yeah, I don't know about that like exact sort of event, but you know. But I think that makes sense for exercise in general. You know, people tell you like, oh yes, it's good to exercise while pregnant. You can walk gently in a field of pillows or maybe do some yoga. And like, okay, but there are other things people do, right? Like anybody who has a physical job where they keep on lifting things, you know, like, you know, like a lot of people continue with their job, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my train of thought here. I was going to tell you about, marathon day. So I stuck with this 5:30 pace group.
Okay.
I've since run with other pace groups, but like this 5:31, I wish I could remember the woman's name who ran it. She was like so like friendly and everything. And she was like, we're going to run 5 minutes and walk for 1 minute. And, you know, like every mile mark, and we're going to walk all of the water stops. And I was like, oh good, this is sounding easy. And, you know, and she would like ask us, you know, like, so tell me about somebody in your family you're running for or something like that. And she would like talk with us. And like, it was like, just like a little party that was moving. And so like, even when my legs were hurting, it was like, well, I don't want to lose the party.
Yeah. Yeah.
But around, I think mentally the hardest part of the marathon was the part where the full splits off from the half. And I saw people going the other way, and they were going to be done in like, you know, 2 miles after that point. And I wanted so badly to go with them. And I was like, I could do it. And I was like, okay, I just have to like watch them go away, and then I'll be on my own. But, you know, like I'll be like on the race course and not thinking about this anymore. But like, they actually have you run alongside for quite a while because they're like trying to make sure that everybody gets where they need to go. And I kept thinking, I could just go there. I could just go that way.
Yeah.
You know, like it would still be cool to do a half marathon. Mm-hmm. So that was the hardest part, but I stuck with it. And like everything from then on was agony. You know, like it was not fun. It was worth it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't fun.
I can imagine that.
And around mile 20 or 22 or something, I finally just lost the pace grip. I was like, I can't keep up anymore. They're just going to have to go ahead without me. But we had run so much on the course. Like our training group had taken us to almost every part of the race course. I knew, you know, and I knew that it was all downhill after, you know, I'm not sure what mile it is now, maybe mile 22 or something. And I knew that if I got myself to that point, I could just walk home. Like, you know, not home, but I could just walk to the finish line.
Yeah.
I could crawl to the finish line. I could roll up into a ball and fall down to the finish line. Like it was happening. And so at that point I was like, you know what? I'm just going to walk. And, you know, I tried to pick up a jog a few times, but I was, you know, like not feeling great.
After that far. Yeah.
And it turns out there was somebody else in my pace group who just, you know, he was like healthy and fit, but he hadn't trained for a marathon and was just like, yeah, I could do this. And so like he caught up with me and we walked together.
Aww.
Just like,
that's fun.
Just, like, strolling on down to the finish line.
How did you feel like crossing the finish line? Did you cry? Did you like collapse to your knees? I'm like picturing.
Were you so emotionally exhausted? It was like a blank slate. And you're just like,
it was pretty much that. It was just like, thank God it's over.
Yeah.
That was literally my own. It wasn't like, oh, triumphant, I'm great. I was like, thank God it's over. I have this now. Like I can cross this off my list. I've done this. Thank God it's over.
Yeah.
That is quite the feat.
I'll say. So now I'm like energized. So I'm like, this could actually be a cool goal. Like to even do the half marathon or just go for the full and walk downhill, you know, like even something like that.
Yeah. In Pittsburgh, you really just have to get yourself up to like mile 22 and like the rest is gravy.
It's literally downhill after that. Have you ever done any other kind of sports or activities or something like training for a marathon?
So actually the marathon I ran while pregnant was my first marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And after that I've done a couple of halves.
Okay.
So that was, you know, that was, like, it's so much nicer to do the training when you're not pregnant. It's a little bit easier.
I bet.
And honestly, the year after I ran the marathon, I ran the half and like, I didn't train very much. I was basically just coasting on my training from the previous year and it still took me pretty far. So that was great. I run some, you know, like nowadays I don't really have anything specific I'm training for.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of years I played roller derby.
Okay.
And, that was like my like driving force. And like, that's what got me to the gym to do cross training or what
that's
you know,
awesome.
Got me to do running.
What was your position in roller derby?
So roller derby has basically just blockers and jammers and a lot of people do both.
Okay.
But I was mostly a jammer.
Mostly jammer. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's cool. So for people who don't know roller derby, a jammer is your point scorer mm-hmm. in roller derby and they usually put on or always put on, I guess, something on their helmet that has a star on it.
Yeah.
And so for every player of the opposing team they pass, you score a point, correct?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And, that means you have to be a really fast skater and also kind of aggressive because you have to get through the pack every time. So I'm sure the track is probably so tight.
It really is.
As a circle goes, like really trying to stay within that circle. And
yeah, because the entire track fits within, and this is flat track, so it wasn't banked. The entire track fits within a roller rink. And, you know, it might not look that small when you're looking at it, but like, it feels so tight and tiny.
I bet. And then usually there are people sitting on the outside of the ring too. So that probably makes it even more cramped.
Well, there's like there's a 10-foot clearance between the outside of the track and where people are allowed to sit because the referees have to skate around that area.
Yeah.
But like just, you know, for people that aren't quite sure what this looks like. So there's 5 people from each team. So there's, you know, if I'm jamming, there'll be another jammer from the other team. And then everybody else has to stay together in a pack. So that's 8 people, 4 from each team. So 4 that are my friends, 4 that are not my friends, all together. They're like, you're not allowed to do anything if you're not within a certain distance of other people that are in the pack. So like, you know, when I first started playing roller derby with like a brand new league that like we didn't really know what we were doing, there's a lot of like speeding around and whatever. And then as, you know, as strategy got to be more of a thing and I came to Pittsburgh and so the Steel City team is like really good. It's very much more about like, how am I going to get through that pack?
Yeah.
It's not even so much speed as like, how are you going to do this?
Ability, not ability, but like, agility and like
agility, for sure.
Aggressiveness.
Like the plan, you know, like the technique. I guess that's kind of what I'm looking for. Yeah.
So what was your name?
Cruisin' B. Anthony.
Cruisin' B. Anthony. That's awesome. Yeah. And then, so what is the, who's the person that wears the stripe on their helmet?
That's the pivot.
The pivot. And they're the ones who determine the speed of the pack? Is that correct?
Maybe. It depends. Okay. Like, it depends how your team is doing it. And to be honest, I've been retired from Derby for a couple of years, so I'm not up on, like, the current, you know, strategies and plays.
The current lingo.
Yeah. But, I mean, the pivot is so called because they are, because they can become the jammer. So if I'm jamming and I get tired or, you know, or I'm just not being effective getting through the pack and I think my pivot could do a better job, I can take that star, which is like a helmet cover. It's almost like a shower cap. I can take that off my helmet and hand it to the pivot and the pivot can put it on and go and become the jammer. And so I'm just a blocker for the rest of the time.
Okay.
Like she can't pass it back. It's just like, I'm a blocker now. She's the jammer.
For the remainder of the jam.
So does someone else become the pivot then?
No, or? Then you just don't have a pivot. You just have blockers. And you actually don't even have to field a pivot. You can just send four people out with nothing on their helmets and they're just blockers. So
as a blocker, I don't know anything about Derby. Mm-hmm.
We should go sometime. My cousin does it now
with someone.
Who? Which cousin?
Anna.
Anna. Okay.
Havrilla. She does it with the Monroeville team. Are they called teams?
Yeah, well, it's probably a league because usually each, like Steel City is a league, but there are a couple of teams within it.
Yeah, I'm not.
So maybe it's a team with
Steel City. Yeah, I'm not sure which one she's on.
Yeah, Monroeville, I'm trying to think, that is it Wesco? Is that still around?
Maybe she's on this Steel City one. I don't know.
I know Steel City had a team called, like a home team called the Mon Monsters.
Yeah, I was on the Monsters.
Yeah, that's, I think my cousin
Pittsburgh
Emily also
East
did it.
Pittsburgh East Roller Villains.
Okay.
Pittsburgh East Roller Villains. Oh.
Yeah.
Competition.
Her name is Anna Mall. Her name's Anna.
Anna right. Mall.
But yeah, I've been wanting to go to one of her bouts. Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Woo. One thing right. So I guess the question I have, the blockers are trying to prevent their jammer from
scoring points.
They're trying to prevent the other jammer.
Yeah.
If you and I are on the same team, like let's say I'm the jammer and you're one of the blockers. So you don't want the other jammer to get through, but when I come through, you're
blocking their blockers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You want to make a hole. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like once I had gotten used to, you know, like jamming, like whenever I watch football, I really identify with the running backs.
Oh, so that's interesting. Yeah.
So that, you know, to people who haven't seen it, that may be a good, you know, like what a jammer does. Like you're like, you have a path, you have a place you're trying to go. You have a lot of people trying to stop you. You're going to have to like stop and juke around them. And
you want to score.
And
your blockers are like your O-line.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, well, they play offense and defense at the same time. It's part of why I'm not a very good blocker, because like it's hard for me to keep all of these things in my mind at the same time, because you want to like make a wall or some other sort of like formation that you just can't get past. But you also need to pay attention to where your jammer is and, you know, help them to get past, or you're making the decision about like which is more important for me right now, O or D. Because if you think about it, there are not a lot of sports where you play O and D at the same time. You know, you're usually like doing one in one zone and one in another zone, or you have entirely different, you know, teams that do it or whatever.
I'm curious if it's kind of like basketball in a way, because, you know, even though you're still only playing one position, you're still kind of playing both no matter which end of the court you're on, you know.
Yeah, so
but
all
not
I,
at the same time exactly like that is,
all I can picture is our friend Brandy Jackson. Yeah. I feel like she would be an excellent roller derby.
Oh yeah.
Like she was so aggressive in basketball. Like shoving and pushing. She never got called. She never got called fouling or anything, but all I can picture is her doing this and succeeding.
Well, I feel like it's been a while since I've been to roller derby too. Cuz my cousin got married and also retired, and I feel like it was all about butts and elbows. Like, you know, you're like getting your butt and your hips into it to like check people, but then your elbows are also like a little bit involved. Can you throw elbows?
No. Oh.
Yeah. So are there fouls?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So legal hits, let me think of a simple way to break this down. Mostly you're hitting people with your hips and your shoulders.
Oh, that's
it. You cannot use your elbow. If
butts
you
and
use
shoulders.
Your elbows, or if your like elbow even comes up a little, like you hit somebody with your shoulder and you sort of like push off with your elbow, it's like sort of very natural to do that. Like you can be in the penalty box for that.
Mm. Oh, okay. So it's immediate. They yank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty good at it usually.
I want to go to one of these.
I'll look it up because I would
broken assume, the barbell on the road.
Yeah, I'm assuming they're starting soon because
they're
usually summer is their season, right?
Yeah, and so I don't know exactly what they're doing now, but when I played, we would do a home team season through the winter and then the travel teams in the summer.
Okay.
So I'm sure, I know that the Steel Hurton, so the like flagship A team,
the big guys, yeah.
They're starting their season now. I just saw some Facebook posts, you know, because I'm still like friends with everybody. So they're like getting ready and they actually have a European tournament this year.
I remember a few years back that they went to London.
Went
or
to
something.
London, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's crazy. So we try to do the mental health spin on things. Mm-hmm. And Carly, if you want to talk about your article that you found.
Yeah, so one of your articles that you wrote was pretty recent on the getting through the urge to self-harm with apps. I didn't even realize they had apps for that. But could you just talk a little bit about those apps and any feedback that you found on them or...
Yeah. Let's see. Do you have it?
Yeah. Yeah. Here. Up, it's right here.
So I can remember what I wrote.
Yeah.
I didn't know about this either until I, you know, I just like found these apps one day and it turns out there's a bunch of them. But there are these apps that like are something you can go to whenever you are feeling an urge to self-harm. So this can be like, you know, people who do like cutting or something, but it can also, a lot of these are good for like getting you through a panic attack or some sort of, you know, like situation. So one of the ones that I wrote about is called Calm Harm. And it says, you know, this urge to hurt yourself is like a wave and it's strong at the beginning, but if you ride the wave, it'll be over. And so they give you some ways, some things that you can do, to like distract yourself. And, hang on, there are a couple of these different ones that do it different ways, but some of them it's like, they'll ask you, do you want to distract yourself? Do you want to call somebody for help? You know, and some of the distraction ones, it'll just be like, look around the room and find five things that are green, you know, or, you know, things that'll like keep your mind busy, like find your, you know, like think of the lyrics of your favorite song and recite it backwards. But then a lot of them will encourage you to reach out to, you know, to like call a friend or to make a list of friends you can call or to one of these apps. I'm not sure which one's which, but one of these apps has like a forum built in that's like an anonymous forum, but you can post about how you're feeling and you can help other people out, which can also make you feel better.
That's cool. We'll definitely, really cool. In our show notes, we'll definitely link to it and like,
yeah,
so you guys can go see the article to begin with. And then in there are links to these apps. Some are just Apple, some are Apple and Android.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're different ones. Like one of them is like just a mood tracker, and some of them include a mood tracker so you can keep track and you can look back over your month and see like I had this many good days and this many not so good days, and you know, like see improvement even if you're not like, even if you don't feel great that day, you can look back and be like, oh, I haven't had a panic attack in a week.
Yeah, and that even gets into the mental, that just made me think about like the mental health of weight and eating disorders and stuff like that. And we saw the article that you posted about the scale that was green, yellow, red.
Yeah.
And that's really cool because it takes, I mean, even myself, I get discouraged on the scale at the gym is like my go-to scale. Like that's the one I'm most consistently using, but then you get that extra pound or two and it can be crappy sometimes. Yeah. So it's like, you know, I was like, oh, that'd be kind of cool to have at home. So I'm not.
So you just know whether.
Well, and I think about too, like with trying to like, okay, gain weight via muscle, you know, like that kind of thing. It's like you can't get so hung up on the number when you want to build muscle, I think.
Yeah. So like in this meat prep that I'm in right now, I'm in the super heavyweight class, represent. But I was trying to get down to the lower one and I was sticking to my plan and doing everything I was supposed to be doing and added cardio and all this stuff. And I looked better, but my weight was going up and I waited too long to weigh myself. And so I was like really discouraged. Then I was like, maybe I need a new scale. And so my boyfriend got me one of those Fitbit ones for Valentine's Day. And so now I can track my progression like across the board. I can see when I weighed myself and how much I weighed and whatnot, which is, I think, bad. But it's going down right now. So I'm like, yay, that's exciting. But like it would have been nice to have the colors, whereas instead of focusing so much on the number.
Do you does that give you any more? With the Fitbit thing, like, does it give you any more control or any more information that might be beneficial than just the number?
It gives you your body fat percentage, which I'm told is not accurate, but it's still annoying to see.
Yeah.
I wish I could turn that feature off. I don't know if you can.
Can you put a sticker over top of it?
So it's a digital scale. So you'll stand on it and it'll show you your weight. And then immediately after it shows your body fat percentage.
It'll flash to that.
Yes.
So it's like, look your weight and then like look up.
Yeah, just step away.
Well, I have a scale. It's a different brand, but it does that. Mm-hmm. And so, but like you have to stand on it for a minute before it like figures out your body fat percentage. So sometimes mm-hmm. I'll stand on it and be like, okay, it got my weight and just walk away.
So I guess, well, mine takes a minute to show my weight. And I guess mm-hmm. that's when it's doing the shock or whatever yeah. they do.
It has a little metal foot
like
things.
It's measuring resistance. So it doesn't like shock you, but it's just sort of like measuring. If I did shock you, how would it go?
How long it takes to go through your body or something is mm-hmm. what they said. How the speed hits.
Yeah. Because they have those like the little handheld ones at Gold's Gym that mm-hmm. the personal trainers like to try and hide. And I'm like, I know where you keep them. So yeah. I'll like go and do them. But it's the same thing. You hold the little metal handles and it does the thing, but I haven't done that in a long time, but
yeah, I think those
probably bad.
I think in your article you said those scales were like $100, which is the same as what the Fitbit one was. Mm-hmm. But for anyone that would make sense, if you want to maintain or if you want to lose and whatnot, and you're not worried about the number, but like powerlifting, you are worried about your weight mm-hmm. and what you weigh for a certain weight class. So I mean, maybe when I'm not prepping, I'd be interested in just whether I'm maintaining or going up or going down.
Yeah, I don't know if I love like the product and the company, but I love the idea that like it's not giving you a number. You just, you know, it just sort of keeps track of the trend for you and says, mm-hmm. yeah, you're doing great, or like, here's how you're doing. And like, this should be possible in software. Like, I'm waiting for somebody to make an app that can just hook into your Fitbit scale or your, you know, whatever scale you have, and just like tell you how the trend's been going.
Yeah.
Or even just like give you the graph of what your weights have looked like, mm-hmm. but take off the numbers.
Yeah, that'd be nice. So this is similar to that, but it's a different realm. There's a clothing company called Girl Clothing. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's like GRRRL. And their whole basis is they don't do sizes. They do names. So you have to look at their size chart. So say like it's like an Amelia is a small or a Katie is a medium. Like, so instead of like associating with, oh, I'm an extra, extra large, a Sarah or something. You know what I mean? So they're trying to like...
So you might need to know what your size is at first, but then it kind of takes off. Maybe
it's less negative. Yeah.
Yeah.
The sting doesn't hurt as bad when you get that. You look and see that you're like an extra, extra large. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I haven't ordered anything from them. They're like a European company. So I'm hesitant to order from them because I feel like I'll never get the product. But, I kind of like what they're doing. They're trying to spin how women view their body in such a negative way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we just like latch on to numbers, you know, like whether it's like a number of calories or a number of pounds you weigh or like mm-hmm. a size, like it's just so easy to be like, oh, that's my number. And like you identify like your personality with some number.
Yeah.
And that's, and then if it's more or if it's less, that says something about you.
Well, even look at, I don't know about you personally, but I buy my clothes from all over the place and I could be one size, mm-hmm. one store and two sizes up another, two sizes down and another. So it's just like.
Yeah, but like if you go to a store where like you try take your regular size to the dressing room and you're like, oh no, this doesn't fit.
Yeah.
Like you feel bad about yourself, even though like it's not you. It's mm-hmm. just that this store sizing is different.
Yeah, exactly. Real quick, I want to just touch on whether Amazon comes to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I like that article.
Is that one of the articles that you found her on, Tanner? Because he sent it to us and we all read it and we're like, wow,
that's what started it. Yeah,
pretty eye-opening. And I think that same week at my work we had a panel discussion with someone from the Downtown Pittsburgh partnership and some real estate developer from Bakery Square, and they were talking about the different ins and outs of whether Amazon will come mm-hmm. and how that would change everything.
I'd be really curious what they were saying about that.
So they talked a lot about the infrastructure and transportation, and they just said they need to like ramp up their busing systems, and they talked about the potential of extending the T to like Lawrenceville in that way.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Wouldn't that be
nice? Yes, please. Oh, my God.
But they didn't give any definites on anything. They didn't give any insight on whether they're coming. But it was really interesting to hear what they had to say about it, given that they are the developers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But to me, ramping up the transportation, in 5 years, say Amazon comes next year, I'd say in 5 years, no one's going to be physically driving their vehicles anymore. How can they? It would be a total gridlock.
Well, that's like a huge problem in Washington State, right? In
Seattle. Right?
Yeah. Like they have a huge traffic problem.
I get annoyed right now and Amazon's not even here. So I'm just like thinking down the road because I've been thinking through my head what I would do because I live in Beachview. What part of the city do you live in?
I'm in the North Hills. We don't have any public transportation up there. So when maybe more public transportation, I'm like anything.
Yeah.
I used to live in Brighton Heights and there was like one bus that I could take. I could take two. And the one bus took almost an hour and the other one was half an hour. So moving here, just recently, I'm riding the East Busway, and that is already like so much better than it was in North Hills. I'm like, why don't they? Do they do a North Flyer, anything like that?
There is. There's one that goes. There's one that goes up McKnight, and there might also be one that goes up Route 8 or Mount Royal. Actually,
how can a McKnight Flyer be fast?
It's not.
Yeah.
So there are buses that go out to where I am, but the only way to get anywhere is to take that bus into downtown and then transfer to wherever you actually want to go.
Yes.
And that's just never makes sense. Like, no matter where I'm going, you know, I love when I visit other cities and I can like take a subway somewhere or take a whatever and like not have to worry about parking or whatever. I just like hop on a train and like I so wish I could take a bus or, you know, imagine if there was even a train or something.
Yeah.
That's not how it works.
All I can think of right now too is how horrible these potholes are.
Oh my God.
And then now imagine that the city of Pittsburgh gives Amazon like a $5 billion tax credit or something like New Jersey did. Like, what was there, 7 billion tax credit?
It was insane.
And it's
I don't know.
Could you just imagine the shithole Pittsburgh would be?
No, honestly.
With
and
that
like,
kind of tax break for a large company of that size, and then you're adding 50,000 people to the population. Like,
yeah, and
that's all I think.
And they made the argument like, well, all those people won't be living in downtown. It's like, yeah, but what about the rest of us that have to get to work downtown? You know what I mean? Like,
well, and
it's not all about the employees that we're worried about. It's more so like Pittsburgh's already set up to fail because downtown is literally a point. And you have to cross a bridge to get to it. So that right there is a disaster infrastructure wise.
In the great scenario, I just saw something with Bill Peduto talking about it, like, supposedly, because it's all secret, we don't know, but
all
like,
up in the air.
Supposedly, you know, it's the best of both worlds, because he based his thing off of the problems Seattle had, is what he says.
Well,
you know?
I mean, it's good to know.
Yeah,
but...
so it's like, you know, okay, fine, because we're... This is like a political discussion, but like, fine, if you give them a tax break, maybe part of the deal is they pay a ton into the public transportation system or something like that. But who knows how any of that works?
Yeah.
Me down here, the peon at the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know any more about it than you do, but yeah, it's like, you know, like, isn't part of the point of having something great here, you know, like that they help to pull their weight, you know, rather than the rest of us, you know, like having to subsidize Amazon, you know,
because
when you think about it, like there's a lot that, you know, goes into your life that you don't personally pay for that comes from, you know, like the either the government or somebody else picking up your slack, you know, like somebody else paves the road, somebody else, you know, deals with the pollution that comes off of such and such.
Takes out your trash and your recycling.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
And one of the big things too, I think on the Amazon front is the cost of living, and I think we are all lucky to be living in Pittsburgh right now, but it's like
the second that
a lot of people that I know and myself included have been looking to buy now because you want to buy before we get that bid because it's just going to skyrocket. I mean, I think the fact that Pittsburgh, and they made this point a lot in the panel discussion, is the fact that Pittsburgh's even on the map for it, even in talks for the bid, is a good thing for the city without it coming here. I mean, they didn't really say that per se, but
I think it's true. Yeah
I mean, the fact that Pittsburgh's even a contender is a big win for the city. And I last week or 2 weeks ago, they were Bill Peduto tweeted, like, I have a huge announcement for the city of Pittsburgh. Like,
you texted
Tom
us.
Wolf is in town and all this stuff. I'm like, oh my God, this are they making it? The Amazon announcement? But I was
about to call and like get a homeowner's loan.
It was that Pittsburgh's no longer under Act 47, and that is a big win for the city. It wasn't the Amazon news as much as they were hyping it up to make it seem like it was.
So wait, what is Act 47?
So that was the act that like cities were under financial distress. So I'm trying to think of an example.
Well, we weren't in control of our books, essentially.
Yeah, so
we had to have an advisor or something.
We were
like
placed
that.
Under it in 2003, I believe. So Pittsburgh was under it for 15 years. My previous job, I was a paralegal at a labor and employment firm, and we did a lot of collective bargaining for Act 47 municipalities. So it was essentially saying, like, your policemen don't need to be paid a ton of money whenever we're struggling financially.
Mm-hmm.
So Pittsburgh, that's been lifted now. We're no longer under financial distress, which is a big win.
And hopefully good things can happen.
Yeah. So do you think that's, you know, a good thing going forward, or?
You probably know more about it than I would.
I mean, sure. I think it's a good thing just that it makes Pittsburgh look better. Because, like, I've a fun, so let me use the example. Aliquippa is an Act 47 municipality, so, like, it's not a thriving place. But Pittsburgh is up and coming. Every day you see... But you want to say something?
I'm curious about, like, every day you see new things opening?
Yeah, and just look at what happened with Google in Bakery Square. So... Look at all the apartment buildings over there, which the only people that can afford them are Google employees.
Yeah.
So they're like building up East Liberty, which I used to live right on the corner of Friendship and East Liberty. So like right at the divide.
Okay.
And East Liberty wasn't a nice place. And everyone would be like, ooh, East Liberty. But now it's like...
Duolingo's there too.
And, yeah, building it up. And I'm just curious to see if Amazon does come here, where they're going to go.
Mm-hmm. Well,
happens to the neighborhood they move into,
the local population.
What happens to the people that aren't employees in that neighborhood?
Like, you know, will they still be able to afford to live there,
or are they going to be forced out? That's what I'm curious to see how they handle it, because I mean, realistically they could put them out by the airport. I'm guessing that's a total guess. I have no idea where it's going comes.
There are several different sites, and they actually talked about that at one of my meetings at work, was the brownfield at the Almano Steel site, which I think is where Uber drives its cars around on its fake tracks.
Oh, really?
And then
where is that?
That's over by like near the Hot Metal Bridge.
Okay.
So then the big question comes in about how bad traffic is there now. Mm-hmm. How do you know we're going to make 50,000 employees go there?
So something Amazon expanded in Pittsburgh in the last week.
With their place on the south side.
Yeah, that piece expanded. I did see that. Mm-hmm. And so now there's talks, like, does that mean it's coming?
Does that mean they know? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure someone knows.
Or could it
knows.
Be, like, a sort of test thing? Like a
just to see.
Thing.
So there was something, I can't remember the name of it, some, like, tech website you might know better than
it's
something geek
geek wire
reached out to Pittsburgh and wanted to start a Pittsburgh like
they're doing their own HQ2
because of the potential Amazon bid. Sought out Pittsburgh because of that.
GeekWire HQ2 in Pittsburgh.
So is this like they would want to have, this is like for like writing and reporting, they would want to have like feelers out there?
Yeah, they're doing like, so here's some articles. Like, Pittsburgh goes to court to keep Amazon HQ2 proposal secret. What happened to Yahoo's $10 million alliance with CMU, and how could it help AI restore our humanity? How is that part of this?
But yeah, so GeekWire sought out Pittsburgh.
Oh, this is so cool.
Yeah. So it's like, this is their whole HQ2 special coverage. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so So hypothetically, they have people here writing these articles and stuff.
Isn't that crazy, though, that they wanted in just because Pittsburgh was one of the contenders?
Yeah. I mean, I imagine it's probably also, you know, like, we've got Google, we've got Uber, we've got a lot of stuff going on. So that could be like, you know, like the last thing that makes them go like, okay, this is a place worth covering.
And CMU in and of itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
That with their computer programs, it's just...
I've seen interesting back and forth things, too, is the unknown reason we're going to get it is because higher ups in Amazon own property here, like personal property. So it's like, and they have ties to CMU in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was why we're not going to get it is because of we probably didn't offer a lot of tax breaks and our infrastructure mm-hmm. has its problems, like living in the North Hills, you know? Yeah. So
yeah, back to that infrastructure thing. I live in Beachview and I could take the T. I work downtown. I could take the T to work every day, but I don't. So I've been like going through these scenarios in my head, like, well, if it does come, I can take the T to work and then I can take a bus to my gym in Lawrenceville and then bus back downtown and then get back on the T. But that just seems like such a hassle. But I guess if I did it every day, I would be used to it.
Well, and you get into the problems too with nighttime travel on public transportation. Things yeah. slow down. And like, I saw a girl, we were downtown last night. We went to dinner. And this girl is running down the oncoming traffic lane because her bus is down there.
Oh, no.
And I can only assume if she didn't catch it, it was like 8:30 at this point, mm-hmm. she'd have to wait until 9:30 or 10 to get another bus. So
and they don't wait for you.
No.
Like in all the movies when you're like, you see people sprinting like, wait, that's my bus.
And then they nicely
never
stop.
They never wait. I've seen it happen almost daily. They don't wait. Yeah. They don't care. And they're never on schedule. So mm-hmm. that a big topic in that panel discussion was the fact that they need to revamp our public transportation, and I couldn't agree more. Those bus drivers are crazy.
Well, maybe Act 47?
Yeah, Act 47.
Municipality, maybe it'll help some of that way, but
I don't think that's going to be an overnight change, but
oh, well, it's a huge thing, you know.
Yeah.
Sam, do you have anything else to add? You want to talk about Amazon?
Bring Amazon to Clarion. We need jobs.
Yeah.
Amazon and Clarion PA. Yes.
Let's you imagine? It would be a mess. But I don't think I have anything except for after my 26 years of living, I found out what an epidural really was. Uh-huh. And I don't know how I'm going to give birth now.
Just call the whole thing off. Because <Yeah. laughs> that's totally feasible at this point.
By the time we record our next pod, he should be here.
Yep.
Oh my God, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Well, we wish you luck.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Do you have anything else you want to touch on? Any advice for
No, I
the masses.
I can't really think of anything else.
We dissected Amazon in the city of Pittsburgh, so I mean,
yeah, I mean, we'll just wait it out, see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Thank you for talking to us. It's so cool.
Yeah,
you're our
for
first
inviting me here.
Verified on Twitter interview. So
feel very special now.
Yeah, if you guys want to follow Beth or look up some of her stuff, she is on Lifehacker under the Vitals vertical. And she has a lot of great articles out there. I think we only scratched the surface with some of them because some of those were even a little bit older. There are some new articles that are interesting that I need to read. Like
I write for Lifehacker literally every day, usually many times a day. So
okay, yeah,
usually multiple times. I should say multiple.
Yeah, because you have things like why non-alcoholic beer is Germany's sports drink.
Yeah,
and the push-up challenge.
Oh, the push-up challenge.
Going?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
That's good. But yeah, if you want to follow Beth on Twitter, she's at Beth SKW. And I assume you can find that the same thing on Lifehacker. Is it like at Beth SKW there, or is it your full name?
It's just if you just go to Lifehacker, you know, like there's articles there and a bunch of them are by me.
Yeah.
So you'll see it pretty quick. Yeah. Or if you just go to vitals.lifehacker.com. That's our health section, and I write almost everything there.
Awesome. Yeah, that's really cool. You'll find, I just went to the main page and found a lot right there on the main page that are mostly all you and maybe a couple others, but...
Yeah, Vitals is like, I edit and write that section, but mostly that means like I'm writing most of it, and then there's a few things by other folks that I bring in, so...
That's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on. I already feel inspired.
Yeah.
To write some more.
Oh, that's awesome.
And everything that we covered, it was kind of all over the board, but you had a wealth of knowledge on everything, so we appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here. This is really fun.
Yeah, no problem. And we'll definitely, in the show notes, guys, we will link with a time code to everything we talked about today. So you'll be able to see the articles we talked about and follow Beth on Twitter and find more of her articles to read. So thank you, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks again.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.